Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
And welcome once again, everybody, to Lost in the Static. Happy to have you here with us today.
Indeed. And since I gimped it up last week, would you like to properly do the anime promo?
Okay, as long as you do me a favor and move your mic closer to your mouth
and
to the side as I told you last week.
I did.
Okay. It's real simple. You go to adamandeve.com, you pick out what you want, and they have everything from clothing to some fetish items to
objects,
DVDs, insertables, things in which to insert, and other various playthings for you and a lover, or just for you. Be selfish. You deserve it.
Treat yourself.
Exactly. At the very end, you enter the promo code STATIC, STATIC, and you get 50% off of a single item, 3 free DVDs, free shipping in the U.S., and a mystery gift. Ooh. Okay.
AdamandEve.com.
AdamandEve.com. And we talked last week kind of about the big early 80s first generation boom of home video game systems.
And which ended in 1983 when E.T. as well as other outside forces collapsed the video game industry.
Absolutely
in upon
killed
itself.
It. Right.
And yeah. I mean, it was so bad at the end of that thing about E.T., there were so many return cartridges, they literally buried them in the desert. That's not an urban legend. Warner Brothers has confirmed they did it.
Okay. But we were sure in 1983 that that was it. That was a neat little blip. We had our home entertainment systems, and now
time called it. Time was like the video game industry. Maybe computers will last a few more years, but it's gone. It's dead.
Right.
Nothing can resurrect it.
Exactly. And so amazingly, for 2 years, we all concentrated on our Apple IIes and our TRS-80s and stuff.
And our coin-ops.
And our coin-ops.
Arcades were still doing quite well. The video game crash, when we say that, that doesn't mean video games in general died. That's basically the home system. Arcades took a small hit, but arcades were still doing quite well at this point.
And arcades were, actually, arcades were bumping. They were happy to have them die because from 83 to 85, the kids came back into the arcade and did their thing.
Plunking quarters into them some bitches, yeah. So then this weird little... And see, a lot of people don't realize that Nintendo is a company that's over 100 years old.
Oh, Nintendo's been around for centuries. And
making games.
Making chiefly prior to 1985 or 84, actually, I think.
85 in Japan, 86 is when it launched in America.
Yeah, I knew there was a year difference. I wasn't sure exactly what years they were. But prior to 85, they concentrated on card games. So you would see things from regular poker decks of cards, Nintendo branded, to games similar to Yu-Gi-Oh or Pokemon with the collectible card games, although not to that degree. But you would see collectible card games from Nintendo and small one-off games and stuff like that, but chiefly pen and paper or just cards. And then...
But most people know Nintendo from the 80s. So when you say that there's a century of history, they're like, they weren't making video games 100 years... No. Video games. just games.
Board games and stuff like that. And they got an idea of going, okay, we'll make this thing called the Famicom. Because although the video game crash in the U.S. was devastating...
It wasn't nearly as bad
in Japan. It was bad. There was still a crash.
The Atari VCS still, they had enough units in stores that it still sold. Yeah. Even though the new ones were not being produced, it still sold well enough in Japan. In America, it was, oh, the Atari's dead, screw it.
Exactly. In Japan, it still sold well enough. It was a mediocre market, but it was still around. And Nintendo goes, all right, let's get our mitts into this. And so, basically, they came up with this little system called the Famicom, which in the States released a year later
as the Nintendo Entertainment System. And they redesigned the controllers, which at first, I know how weird this sounds, guys.
That's it.
But you have to realize just how revolutionary the D-pad was. It looked like, how am I supposed to play a game like this? It looked like it was unusable. You have to realize how inventive this was in 85.
Yes.
The D-pad.
Yes.
To play a game without a joystick? Are you nuts?
Yeah.
Now it's just a given. And the D-pad's way more comfortable than a joystick nowadays, too.
I don't know. I still like my arcade stick, especially for fighters and stuff. But it's got to be a good stick.
With a big bulbous head?
Sure. Or, you've seen my throttle and stick combination for flight games. Joystick still has its place.
And the Famicom had, unlike the Vectrex, a long enough cord on the controller that were not smushed up against your TV. It had
a 12-foot cord. This was amazing.
It had a wide library of games. And keep in mind, this isn't even coming to America yet. Had a wide library of games, 8-bit graphics, much better sound.
Yes.
And still relatively expensive, but still kind of taking the Atari model of, we're not going to be egregiously expensive for the hardware. It's the software where the money will get made.
Exactly. Now we're up to about $40 a game in those 2 years, which is still, that's not chump change.
For inflation, that's still a lot.
Yeah, it's not chump change, but that's
Zelda, when that came over here in 86, that was $60.
Yes.
In $86.
Yes.
Because that had the memory chip and all that.
Yes, but the other thing that Nintendo did was they looked at Atari and they looked at that kind of that open-ish concept. And they said, no. They said, if you want to produce games for us, we have to okay it. Or really what they did for the most part was develop all the games internally. And that way they knew that crap games, at least mostly
in theory,
would stay off the system.
That they really relaxed that later after a lawsuit, which I'll get into in a little bit, because we have to introduce their main competitor. And just like the law of threes that you and I discussed last week, this one is no different. You had Atari trying to come back with the 7800, which Atari controlled a maximum of 2% of the market at any given time in this generation, Scott. Atari just could not come back. Warner Brothers controlled Atari, tried with the 7800. It had 8-bit graphics, better sound. But because of that, because of the thing that Sega would run into,
right?
Nintendo had what is later determined by the Supreme Court to be illegal policy that if you made games for the Nintendo,
you could not.
They
make
were
games.
Exclusive.
Yeah.
You could not make games for our competitors. That's illegal because that is basically saying competition. What is competition?
Exactly.
But at the time, they had complete and utter control of this. So that said, Atari just could not compete at all.
Well, Atari made a couple other mistakes too. Number one, the actual physical design of the 7800 and such
was ugly. Honestly,
it was horribly ugly. The controllers were
bulky.
Bulky, absolute crap. They kind of tried to hybridize the old standby joystick, and
they basically didn't learn anything from the 5200.
Exactly,
which kind of came at the tail end of the last. We didn't talk about because it was essentially the 2600 with a tiny, itty-bitty tweak in graphics. That's about it.
And with the 7800, you had that huge controller that was nigh on unusable because they went, okay, we'll make a paddle and a joystick and a keypad all in one. We'll give it 4 shoulder buttons and another one, and the joystick will twist
and
move around.
And keep in mind,
and
these
blah,
are
8-bit
games. You don't need that many buttons at this point in video game history, dude.
Right. It was uncomfortable. The games weren't compared to the Nintendo, the games were meh.
They were dull, honestly. Yeah.
The sound wasn't there. The graphics were a mediocre step up. It was just kind of a bleh system. And we had one for a short while. And also, I remember hooking it up with the Atari 7800. You still had... You remember with the 2600, there was an actual physical switch.
Yes.
Where you would leave it hardwired into your TV, and at the time it was usually the two little...
Yeah, and you, there was a switch up and down
switch
for
up and down.
Essentially the power button.
And you had the same thing for the 7800, at least at the beginning. Whereas the Nintendo, you put it on the right corner or right channel, you turn it on, and bloop, there it was.
Right. But there was another competitor in this, and that was Sega with the Master System, or as it was the Mark II and the Mark III other places, but we had in America the Master System.
Right.
And that should have been a real competitor because it had better graphics. This is not going to the Super and Sega Genesis era. The Master System had a faster processor and a larger graphics card.
Yes.
It had better graphics and better sound than the Nintendo. And the controller was essentially a ripoff of the D-pad that Nintendo had.
Yes.
But the problem was because of that now, or at that time, not illegal exclusivity, Sega could not get games.
That's right.
They had a few in-houses like the Phantasy Star series, but... The only reason Sega got 14% of the market was because Sega also produced coin-op games, so they already had the licenses for porting all of their arcade games to their system.
Exactly.
So it was Nintendo had the original games, and if you wanted to play arcade classics at your home, that's what you bought the Master System for.
Exactly.
And the Master System might not have been a big splash here. Holy fuck. South America, the Master System crushed Nintendo in sales.
Yes.
The Master System lasted until 1996, still making games for it in South America, Scott.
10 years.
That is amazing for a cartridge-based system.
Yes, it is.
So, I mean, it's just we're looking at the Master System as a failure here in America, more or less. That doesn't equal worldwide. Worldwide, yeah. The Master System... did much better in non-English speaking countries.
Yes, it made a little bit of a splash over in Europe, but South America, it just took the hell off.
And Nintendo just started dominating the market. They were putting out a lot of quality games. They were putting out a lot of innovation. I mean, just Legend of Zelda. Not only two different quests. I mean, you got a good... Let's say you explore everything and you don't know where everything is located... You got a good 10, 20 hours of gameplay out of that one game. And the ability to save your game.
Yes.
Was something so radically new, it cannot be overlooked.
Now, there was another angle of Nintendo that we can't overlook. Nintendo Power. The Nintendo-produced magazine.
The tie-in magazine.
The
yep.
tie-in magazine that if you had a Nintendo system, you wanted Nintendo Power. It had the maps. It had the info. It had information on Easter eggs and reviews.
I think the second iteration of the NES came with like a free four-issue subscription or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
I think you got a free mini subscription just for buying the system or something.
Because they knew that once Nintendo Power ended up in the kids' hands, it was going to be something that they asked mom for the rest of time.
But think about this from a marketing perspective, how brilliant this is for Nintendo Power, okay? You're going to pay us to subscribe to us advertising to you. Think about how brilliant that is. You're going to pay us... so we can sell you ads.
Well, I mean, it's
brilliant in a way.
It's kind of like GameStop and Game Informer.
Yeah.
You know, it was this tie-in magazine that just made kids go crazy. And I remember even when I didn't have an NES, and I didn't for a long while.
I got it the first Christmas it was available, and then I got Legend of Zelda for my birthday, which, you know, is 2 months after Christmas.
Well, you got to understand that when it comes to my dad, who made all of the
dough.
The dough and the decisions on who had what in the house. Number one, he and mom got a divorce at this time. This was during their divorce. And so he wasn't around to play games with me, so what's the point of me having a game system? Two, he got burnt by Atari. My dad was from
the
Atari.
Crash.
He was an Atari fanboy. He loved the 2600. We bought the 7800 when it came out, and it lasted a good 3-4 months in the house before it broke beyond recognition. And it took him a long while to go, okay, we can try this home video gaming thing again. I didn't get an NES, I think, till 1989 because, we were also traveling.
Right.
And living in Kansas City for a while and blah, blah, blah. But
I would also like to point out something you just reminded me of.
Sure.
The Nintendo Power thing, that was not the first time that had happened. Atari also had a tie-in magazine called Atari Age, which was basically the Atari version, or the Nintendo Power was a Nintendo version of what Atari Age was.
And I don't even remember Atari Age.
I remember subscribing to Atari Age. I had the silver jacket and whatnot that I wanted in a contest from Atari Age. So Nintendo Power wasn't the first one to do that. They were just the most successful at it.
Yes. But I remember getting Nintendo Power from my friends. Even though I didn't have a Nintendo, I would read through the magazine and, this was really cool stuff.
And
it just took a long time for my family to turn around and say, okay.
Well, and then here was another big issue between Sega. Because, let's not even talk about Atari at this point anymore because they're a non-player. They're really a non-starter in this. This is Sega versus Nintendo at this point.
They tried a little bit later, but we'll get there.
The Jaguar, yeah. But right now it's Atari versus Sega.
And Nintendo versus Sega.
Nintendo versus Sega, sorry. And Sega tried the Nintendo Power with Sega Visions. That was their magazine.
Yes. Again, I don't even remember it, so.
Yeah, the Sega Visions, it existed. It didn't last all that good. And then there was the whole fact of going back to the Atari model, pack-in games. What did the Nintendo come with?
Mario Brothers and Duck Hunt.
Well, that's only if you got the Zapper. So let's just say Mario Brothers is the overall. A great game that anybody can get into.
Yes.
So what does the Sega Master System come with? Road Rash, a racing game. You don't care about racing games, who gives a fuck?
Exactly.
It was a really, really poor pack-in title. That was a stupid pack-in title. And then later they had Jungle Hunt.
Right.
Again, you cannot compare pack-in titles this regard.
The brilliant thing about Mario Brothers and Duck Hunt, because the one I got came with the Zapper.
Yeah, I didn't get the Zapper at first. So.
I remember my mom getting into Mario Brothers.
Everybody got into Mario Brothers.
Yeah, it was the kind of game that it didn't hit quite as hard culturally with like everybody and their brother as Pac-Man did.
It would a few years later, maybe.
But it hit the right. It's a brilliant game that anybody
it's
can pick up and play.
And complex at the same time.
Yeah, and one thing that I loved was you picked up Mario Brothers, and it was okay. Hit things, go right, stomp on things. That was all taught without tutorials.
Yeah, you did. It was almost intuitive.
Yeah.
How to play. I do this to do this to do this.
Exactly.
There, this is fun. I'm stomping on little Goombas.
Exactly. And it worked amazingly well.
Yeah. And so Nintendo started dominating the market again, partially because of their illegal monopoly.
Right.
And that's what they had. They had a monopoly, which was illegal.
Right.
And Sega just could not find an American inroad until 1991. Now, remember, I believe it's 91. No, actually 88.
88, but, yeah. Before, I was like, no, that's...
You had a little upstart come in to this that said, hey, I can be a real player too. Atari, non-starter. TurboGrafx-16. TurboGrafx-16 came out, and they said, we've got better graphics. We got 16-bit graphics instead of the 8-bit that Sega and Nintendo have right now.
That's right.
We've got CD-quality sound, which was kind of a lie. But, well, I mean, it was much better sound. But it was not,
better sound. It wasn't quite CD quality. But
that's
it was
what they
better.
Advertised it as.
Right.
And we're more able to do arcade ports. Yes. Because of the 16-bit graphics, it's not as taxing on our hardware to do that. So TurboGrafx-16, they were an actual competitor for a little while. And then you also had the mascots. Nintendo had Mario. Sega, Sonic doesn't exist yet, so Sega had Alex Kidd, not a great competitor for Mario, no. But TurboGrafx had Bonk. He was cute, cartoony, and something easily marketable. A very real threat to Mario as a brand mascot.
Ah, yes.
Now, just take a listen to this TurboGrafx-16 commercial, and you'll see what they were trying to do. This is an actual commercial from the early 90s, but it gives you what we're looking for here from when they entered the fray.
Exactly.
Introducing TurboGrafx-16, the next generation video game system. It's 4 times faster, so the games are more exciting. There are almost 10 times as many colors, so the arcade quality graphics are even more intense. And you can expand your system with a CD player for CD games with sound effects that are turbocharged. TurboGrafx-16 from NEC, the higher energy video game system.
From NEC, the old cash register maker, mm-hmm. is what they, yep. started out making.
And see, the TurboGrafx-16, their big thing, which is something that Sega would do much better a couple of years later, was speed.
Yep.
Their thing, they had the turbo button. Everything was faster, bigger, and their whole thing was speed. And they're the ones that started that whole kind of extreme way of advertising that, you know, Nintendo's for babies. You know, the Sega, again, the Genesis isn't out yet. That's for babies. It's just arcade ports. We've got original games that look better than all of that, and we're for the cool kids, man!
Yeah, they were definitely shooting for the teen, late tween, through the teen through early college age kids.
And they made a couple of massive mistakes right off the bat.
Yeah.
Let's go back to what was the biggest problem with the Vectrex? The cord length. Well, the cord that came with the system was only about 6 feet. So again, you are just trapped.
Yep.
In front of the TV. You could buy an extender for extra money.
Yes.
And then probably their dumbest move was they never even thought about two players. There was a second controller port on the back of the system, almost like it was an afterthought.
Yes.
That we should add a second controller port to this. That hurt them hard. And then, of course, NEC had a lot of money troubles, so they just could not compete. So for a while, TurboGrafx was, yeah, we're here. And again, this went back to a two-player game. You know, mm-hmm. this went back to mm-hmm. a Sega versus Nintendo. This was a two-player fight.
Yes.
And then you had the Jenny come in 1988. 16-bit, better graphics than the TurboGrafx. A little worse sound, but better graphics. They actually were able to do the speed thing that they professed to. And when compared to the NES, they were an entire generation ahead.
Yes.
They had leaped over the NES.
And they started, in their advertising, they started the bit wars. 16-bit yes. versus 8-bit.
Yep.
And they had
their amazing catchphrase, Scott.
Sega does what Nintendo don't.
Yes.
And then, of course, they had the perfect spokesman for the time, Sonic.
Not yet. Initially, their spokesman was Altered Beast.
Yes,
but package? Yeah, nobody remembers that. For about a year, he was the sort of the Sega mascot.
Yeah,
but then when Sonic came in, that's when shit, because they got smart. Altered Beast is not selling systems.
Altered Beast
this thing with Sonic? My God, did sales go up.
Well, there was a problem. Altered Beast, by the very nature of the game itself, it's an arcade port, and it was a slow moving game. I mean, even from the arcade port was a slow moving game.
It was not a wise pack in title.
versus Sonic, which you get. Sonic is much more colorful,
much more fun,
much faster.
literally and figuratively.
Which when they're talking about speed on the system, I remember Sonic moving on the screen, and I'm like, how does anybody keep up with this? This is incredible.
Well, and then you remember in the commercials, they would even have Mario with his little and Sonic just all over the place. So yeah, Sega very much took an upper hand, and for about 2.5 years, Sega just kept eroding Nintendo's share till they actually took a little more than 50%.
Exactly.
Sega really did kick Nintendo's ass for a while there. I think they had 54% of the market at one point. And Nintendo, to their credit, said, we're not going to launch the Super Nintendo early. We're not going to put it out until it's ready. Because a lot of people were like, why is Nintendo taking so long to put out their 16-bit system? And they're like, it's not ready. We're not putting this out until it's ready.
Nintendo, are you listening to yourselves? Are you?
I'm thinking a different regime from then to now. But yeah, and then when they put out the Super Nintendo, the market almost became 50-50 again. Again, you know, TurboGrafx is there, but not...
Yeah,
really. They've got like, I think, 8 to 10% of the market. TurboGrafx exactly. is nothing. But what really made the difference, because Nintendo started to overtake the Genesis, and then one specific thing happened. Mortal Kombat!
Yep.
Mortal Kombat gave Sega the edge that they could have never made on their own, Scott. They could have never gotten the edge that Mortal Kombat gave them. What, for those that don't remember, Mortal Kombat had come out in the arcades and, you know, hyper violent, and then it was getting a home port, and this is when all the Senate subcommittee hearings were happening.
Yep.
And it came to both systems. Nintendo said, we are a family system. We are a family company. No blood. No fatalities. Sega said, hey, come to Genesis. Yeah.
It's in the
blood.
Arcade.
Yeah.
It's in the arcade. It's in our game.
And it sold 15-1 in favor of the Genesis from what I've read. Basically, everyone was saying, you know what, Nintendo? Fuck your puritanical nonsense in this case. I want to tear people's fucking spines out.
Exactly.
So that lasted for a while. And then... You know how the PlayStation came about. I mean, that'll be next episode, but its genesis, no pun intended, is in this episode.
Yes.
Explain to people how the PlayStation would later come about, but how it originated here.
Well, CDs and CD-ROMs had made a huge inroad in home computing, and PC gaming was still... It was still kind of a powerhouse. You still had plenty of PC games.
Because you had much better graphics, yeah, much better sound.
Seventh Guest and 11th Hour at this point, and Myst was kind of coming out at this point, and better graphics, better sound, more data stored on a CD. Nintendo, being smart the way they are, decided, you know what, maybe we should get into this disc system and add it on to the Famicom, because especially in Japan, the Famicom or the Nintendo Entertainment System or the Super Famicom or the Super NES here had a bunch of add-ons, including...
You could see all the ports on there when you bought it. You were kind of like, what are all these
exactly.
things for?
But you could do things like save to a 3.5-inch floppy and stuff like that. Never made a huge hit over here. But
Sega
in
did
Japan,
come out
you could.
With the Sega CD, which is what made Nintendo
Sega
go...
Came, yeah, Sega came out with the Sega CD.
Which we'll get into more in a bit, but that was really poor.
It was an add-on to the Genesis. And you could have CD quality sound. The graphics were a tad bit better. They were kind of playing with 3D at that point.
You had full motion video, but then at the same time...
Full motion video was a thing, and it was a very popular thing.
But we have to go back in the Wayback Machine for people who weren't there. As much as everyone makes fun of full motion video, that was a major advance over pixelated cut or sprite based cutscenes in games.
Exactly, it was astounding, and you had Dana Plato,
Nitro.
Exactly, but you know, and it was more of an adult system. Nintendo went, we should make something like this for our system. So they said, okay, who does CD well? Sony. Sony does CD well. So they went to Sony and they said, make us a system. And Sony made them a system. And Nintendo went,
we don't like it.
Nah, we're going to stick with cartridges all the way through the N64 and everything like
and
that.
And Sony basically said, we've already got the basis of this. So next week we'll show you what happened with that. But it was supposed to be competitive in the CD market. Because you had another upstart come in at this point. And I'm not forgetting Atari. We'll get to Jaguar in a minute.
We'll get there.
You had another upstart come in. You had the Philips company, which was also contacted by Nintendo at this point.
Right.
Because, as you pointed out, they were smart. They didn't just go to Sony. Nintendo also went to Philips and kind of, which one of you, you know, kind of competitor, which one of you can make us a better system?
Exactly.
They ended up going with neither. Philips came out with the CDI, which was CD interface, and was a disaster on every... We've long talked, Scott, about that all-in-one system. That's what the CDI was professing to be. You could watch movies, play games. You could do your... Literally do your... There was a tax program. You could do your taxes on this.
Yeah.
You could do everything, and then you'd be able to... They almost had it like one of those Warner Brothers cartoons with the robot house.
Yes.
Where you could, everything, this controller, you know, you literally, they were developing add-ons where it would hook into your electrical system and you could turn on lights with your controller and shit.
Using X10 and stuff like that, yes.
Yeah. For early 90s technology, they were so overreaching. They weren't even in the ballpark of being able to do what they claimed that they could do. And then they made the bizarre marketing decision. Not bizarre that they had Phil Hartman as their spokesman. That's actually a good move.
Yes.
But the marketing was all about Phil Hartman's our spokesman, not about what our fucking technology can actually do.
Yes. Now, here's one of the old CDI commercials.
Before we play this, we should say Phil Hartman is playing all the characters in this. Just so when you get all these weird character voices, including the females, they're all Phil Hartman on
every
screen.
Single
just
one
so
of
you're
them.
Aware.
Say you're watching TV and this guy says,
it's CDI, friends, the next generation CD player that works with your TV.
And you say,
but I have a CD player.
And your mom says,
no, dear, CDI works with your television.
You'd probably feel pretty dumb and maybe even fake it, like you'd already experienced the ultimate in games, movies, music, and more.
Trust me, babe, I know about this CDI stuff.
Now get into CDI, starting at $299 with $200 of free software.
Okay.
Stay you're watching TV.
So, and what's funny is we saw, what, maybe 10 seconds of the actual product there.
Yeah, this was all about Phil Hartman playing
goofy
characters, because that's what he did at Saturday Night Live. So I think they thought, we can kind of hide the product if we hide it behind our spokesman.
Because it really wasn't a bad product for what it was.
But
it's just
do
that
half
what it was bad product.
Well, and it also couldn't do half of what it promised to do. That was the problem. It promised so much, and it just could not deliver.
Exactly.
And then you had the hardware problems, because Philips decided it's too expensive if we make all the systems that we intend to make here. So let's farm this out to third parties. And the third parties didn't talk to one another.
Right.
So some games would play fine on one Philips CDI and then on one that's developed by a different manufacturer, but it's technically the same hardware, it wouldn't play properly.
Right.
So the system as a whole was a clusterfuck.
Yes. And that's this was how a lot of places, people like Microsoft are paying attention at this point. People like Sony are paying attention at this point.
They're basically letting you make all the mistakes so they don't have to.
Exactly. And this is the one that taught, okay, we as a development house have to be in charge of something. And that something may as well be our console. Because we had the Philips CDI and then we had the 3DO.
The 3DO was a little more focused. The 3DO was... video games.
Right.
It wasn't, hey, let's watch movies and control this and do your taxes and be this all-in-one. It was, hey, we're a super advanced system. And Trip Hawkins, my God, you want to talk about overreaching?
Yes.
Okay, did technically have better gameplay and whatnot. Keep in mind, 1990s dollars. The Genesis is about $150. Super Nintendo, about $170. The 3DO, $799.
Yeah, $800, and we what? Just, you know.
You just go, what were you thinking, Trip Hawkins? You wonder why you only sold literally about 14,000 units in the year? You really thought people were going to pay their 2 months' rent for a video game system? Are you nuts?
Yeah. And so, yeah, but, it, you know, you have all of these other companies paying attention at this point, saying, you know, so now we know the right price point. We know what we have to develop versus other people have to develop. And we have to keep all of this in mind. And this is the CDI and the 3DO and the Sega CD. And the Sega CD was, I call it a bridge system. Those CD add-ons.
Because 91 to when the PlayStation would revolutionize it in 95, that's a big four-year gap there.
Yes.
So as much shit as the Sega CD gets, it really does deserve its place. And it overreached, but it reached, at least tried.
Yes. And it did some, they made some horrible decisions when it came to the actual games because it wasn't nearly as interactive as people thought.
And they also, for some reason, thought FMV, full motion video, was going to be the next big craze.
But people were looking for a truly interactive movie and they didn't get it.
No, they didn't.
And what they did get was kind of sprite overlays over very nicely rendered or full motion video backgrounds.
Although, I gotta admit, stuff like Night Trap and Double Switch are not bad ideas.
No.
That you're like basically watching a security camera where there are four or five movies all playing simultaneously, and then your interactivity is clicking on each one at the right, you know, to the right point to interact with them.
Yes.
But the other movies are still going on, so you could get a character killed in movie two by not being there while you're fucking around in movie three.
Yeah.
That's actually a pretty good idea. It just wasn't implemented right.
Right. And again, it was they overpromised. Because again, people were looking for fully interactive movies and they didn't get it at all.
No, they didn't.
But, you know, they tried. I'll give them credit there. And the other thing that they did was, for instance, you know, you talk about the CDI and the 3DO, and the first thing that comes to mind are those horrible, horrible Zelda games.
Yeah.
Where they licensed Zelda from...
And Mario. Hotel Mario.
And Mario, yeah. Zelda and Mario from Nintendo. And...
Which was possibly part of the deal when Nintendo was looking to develop their CD add-on.
Exactly.
That probably was one of the gives they had.
Yes, and part of the problem was they completely lost the spirit of the game. Since they had different developers and such on it, you ended up with these god-awful cutscene animations, badly voiced. Why?
Those were farmed out to a Russian animation studio. That's why those were so bad. They were English. Because they were Russians trying to go weak. I mean, we talked about this a few weeks ago. They didn't get why this dialogue was so bad.
Right.
Because it was Russians. And, you know, this is either, I think this would be right after the Cold War technically ended. They were trying to impress us and they didn't.
Yeah. But, you know, you lose the spirit of the game. And so they failed on that level. They failed to deliver the interactivity that they promised. They failed to deliver the movie library that they promised because
there's like, you know, 20 movies on there.
Yeah, CDV, which is, you know, compact disc video, which was again a bridge between
a precursor to VCD. Really,
it was a bridge between VCD, which again really confusing. CDV versus VCD,
not the same thing.
Not the same thing. And it was also a bridge between Laserdisc and DVD.
Yeah.
And it didn't deliver. Technically, it had better quality than VHS, but it could only deliver on a postage stamp.
well, you know, yeah, and that kind of thing was, okay, you had better quality than VHS on two or three discs for a movie, whereas when Laserdisc had two or three discs for a movie, you had vastly superior quality over
plus
VHS.
Plus extras, et cetera,
right,
et cetera,
so
et cetera.
It was kind of, almost a step backwards in a way.
The studios did not, either VCD or CDV, no studio got behind it. No, nobody did.
No, the consumers most of all. Yeah,
and the consumers most of all didn't get behind it. So your movies didn't take off. You lack the entertainment side of it. Your video games were subpar, slow, difficult to play. Massive load screens, and there was no killer app for the CDI. None. People looked at it and went, I've got a little home computer. I can do that stuff on that.
Better.
If the kids want to play games, I can play better games on the Super Nintendo. I can play better games on
the Jenny.
The Sega Genesis. Now we did have another contender come into this.
Two more,
but one in 1990 that did make a bit of a splash. It priced itself out of existence, but it made a splash.
The Neo Geo's pricing itself out of existence was a necessity. That wasn't ego like with Trip Hawkins and EA and the 3DO. That was ego. The Neo Geo's problem, for those that don't know, our arcade cabinets essentially had giant motherboards in them. Most of an arcade cabinet, just like if you take a Nintendo NES card apart, most of it's air.
Yep.
That's what most of a Nintendo or an arcade cabinet is.
Yes.
More technology is used to actually illuminate the screen than is actually used to make the game appear on the screen.
Right.
So you had these giant motherboards, and what Neo Geo said is, we're seeing, even with the Sega Genesis, these aren't accurate translations. You've got to lose quality, you lose sound, you lose some graphics, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to give you literally the motherboard from the coin-op in a giant cartridge that's about the size of a fucking Trapper Keeper, a giant cartridge for about $600, but you're getting literally the same game you would get in the arcade, but in your home.
Right. Now, Neo Geo came about for arcade owners. Because in the arcades, if I wanted to switch from Donkey Kong to Miss Pac-Man,
you had to change out the whole
cart. I changed out the whole cabinet. I either opened up the cabinet, took out the motherboard, put a new motherboard in, rewired
the
screen.
On the side would be,
you had to peel the graphics off the side, put new graphics on, put new overhead.
It was a pain in the ass, basically.
It was a pain in the butt. So Neo Geo, when they started out, and they started out in the arcade boom. And they said, all right, we'll tell you, we're seeing a lot, if you look at a Donkey Kong board and a Pac-Man board, there are a lot of components that are duplicated.
Yeah.
And so what we're going to do is we're going to take all those components that are duplicated, put them on one big motherboard, and then we're going to do daughter boards. And daughter boards basically plugged into the motherboards, and they were basically cartridges.
Yeah, I was going to say, basically, Neo Geo in the arcade cabinets was they would just swap out the software of the game, and you would have the Neo Geo system, which is what you would have. And then when you got a new game, you'd come in and you would just have them swap out whatever the software cartridge, whatever it was.
Or they just mailed it to you and you did it yourself. It was relatively easy to do.
It was relatively inventive,
well,
too.
Well, Neo Geo in 1990 said, why don't we do this for people at home? We'll package our big-ass motherboard that duplicates a lot of stuff into a much smaller package, and we'll just mail people daughter boards to play their games.
And the system itself was almost $1,000 in 1990, and each game was about $600 to $700. So they did price themselves out of existence, but in one of those rare cases, you got what you paid for, though, too.
Yes, you did.
So even though not a lot of people bought these, it was a quality product that was just outside of, this was the true gamer's console.
Yes.
Was the Neo fucking Geo.
And it was, and it just,
it never made even a dent in America.
Brilliant idea that just couldn't start because
it
people
was too
couldn't
expensive.
Afford it.
Yeah, the price point was just way too high. And then you had, Atari is like that villain at the end of the horror movie that keeps jumping back up. You had Atari jumping back into the fray again, not realizing why they failed when they were taking on the NES and the Master System. This time, they didn't even try to compete. This time they said, we're just going to lie, take the money, and run.
Yeah.
Play the Atari Jaguar commercial.
Okay.
Some of you believe your system is the most advanced in the universe. Let's review the numbers. Sega Genesis is 16 bits. 3DO is 32 bits. The Atari Jaguar is 64 bits. Which is more advanced? Clifford!
Hmm?
16 and 32 are less than 64. So with 64 bits, 3D graphics, real world animation, and lightning speed that you can only get with Jaguar, which is more advanced? Clifford!
Can you repeat the question?
Jaguar!
Jaguar! Jaguar!
The old phrase, do the math.
Except that 64-bit thing was
a lie.
It technically had a 64-bit processor, so that part was not a lie.
Right.
98% of the games didn't even come close to using that. So that's why they were not brought up on fraud charges, because they technically weren't lying.
Right.
The system was a 64-bit system. But almost every one of the games was a 16 or 32-bit game.
That's right.
So they snowed your ass.
Yes. Now, I've played a Jaguar. I had a friend in college that it was the greatest thing on the face of the earth, and he was an Atari fanboy. And so he went out and got a Jaguar day one, and he had three games for it, and that's all he ever had.
Kasumi Ninja, which was the pack-in. Which was a just shameless Mortal Kombat knockoff.
Yeah, it was Kasumi Ninja Tempest 2000,
which is actually one of the few games that everyone goes, that's worth buying this system for. This game fucking kicks ass,
and it did.
Tempest 2000 kicked ass, man. Yeah, I've only played it on an emulator. I can't imagine what it would be like on a system. You know, Tempest 2000 was fucking amazing.
And then he got his third and final game, Bubsy.
I played Bubsy on Genesis. I don't think I've ever played it.
Stupid, floaty, god-awful cat game that Atari tried making Bubsy their spokes mascot for a little while.
I thought Jax, whatever, the little lizard.
Gex was Sega.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay.
But yeah, it was floaty. The controls were terrible. Let's talk about the controllers for a minute.
Oh, my God.
These are the old mistakes of a billion and one buttons, including a full keypad.
Which only 5% of they only made like 30 games for the system. Only 5% of the games use that keypad, so let's make it take up 90% of the controller,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. And it was uncomfortable. I mean, we've heard about controllers that were uncomfortable after some time. These were uncomfortable. They were heavy. They were shit. They were some of the worst controllers ever made.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came out with the toilet seat,
which the Atari Jaguar CD had. Now you're gonna remember, the Sega CD had a failure rate of about 5%.
Yes.
Okay. The TurboGrafx 16 CD, or the TurboGrafx CD, excuse me, had about a failure rate of about 20%. The Atari Jaguar CD had a failure rate of almost 87%.
He went through, bless you, Drew, for going through all of this, but he went through 12
attempts
in 3 weeks. Which, thank God for warranties. In three weeks, he went through 12 of them. Two of which literally let the magic smoke out.
Well, there's a place here in Green Bay that actually has a Jaguar system for sale with a Jaguar CD. Big sticker on it. Tested and works.
Yeah.
This is the selling point. It works.
It does what it's supposed to do.
This is not just a toilet seat. And the reason Scott's calling it that is because it went on top of the Jaguar, and the Jaguar already had like almost a toilet seat shape. So this was like adding the bowl
to a toilet seat.
It was really ugly. At least a TurboGrafx 16 one went on the back. And the Sega CD went on the side. They at least were pleasing looking. Well, Sega CD initially went underneath, but the main one went on the side. Yeah.
Right. And I don't think he ever got any of his CD. I think he eventually just took it back and got store credit.
I think they only made like 10 games for the CD.
Yeah, I don't think he ever got one working on the system. And
the Jaguar just, again, it was like they just will not learn. They just could not compete. They could not take anything away from Sega or Nintendo. They just could not make a goddamn input.
But I will give them Tempest 2000. We played Tempest 2000. It's a killer game.
Aliens vs. Predator is actually a pretty good game on that, too.
Didn't play that one.
The AVP on that is actually quite good.
But this here at the end, let's talk about, because we're getting into what I call, you were talking about how we can break this down generationally, and you wanted to have these add-ons as another generation. And no, these are what I call bridge systems.
Well, the Sega CD was part of this generation easily because of 1991.
Right. And when we get into all of these add-ons, it really led up to the PlayStation, the Sega Saturn and Dreamcast, and which we're going to discuss next week.
Yes.
But the problem with these bridge systems is they're not quite the best cartridge system that's out there, and they're certainly not the best CD systems out there. So you end up with the Sega, so you've got the 32X, which is basically a daughter board processor that didn't really work.
Yeah, it didn't really. It was already taxing the hardware that it had.
Right. And then you have the CD add-on, which was on top of that, which is didn't really work 100% of the time.
Yeah.
And then maybe you had a Game Genie and some other things. You can end up with this huge stack before you finally put in the cartridge.
Oh, Sega made an even bigger mistake in that. That they actually made games, I think three games, that required the Sega CD and the 32X to play.
Yes.
They had 32X CD games. So you had to own everything Sega put out to play these games. That's ridiculous.
Yes, and the games weren't worth it. That's what's ridiculous. The technological improvements brought on by these add-ons were negligible at best.
Well, and then Sega, their final nail in the coffin with this was not thinking their clever plan all the way through. People were complaining about all the add-ons, so they actually made a 32X Sega CD Sega Genesis one unit thing that they sold, which was $100 more expensive than if you bought all three things separately.
Yes.
That is just stupidity on a ridiculous level, Scott.
Yeah.
You guys wanted this. We'll give it to you. It's more expensive than if you buy them separately, so fuck you.
Yeah.
And, dumbasses.
It was some bad marketing. When the processor use and power deal of the Atari Jaguar came out, when it came out that it goes, not really a 64-bit system. It is, but it isn't.
It's only technically.
That hurt. Atari hurt the view of all of the systems.
Oh, yeah. It was guilt by association.
Yeah. And so, maybe Nintendo isn't doing what they're doing, but Atari didn't. Maybe Sega's not doing what they claim they're supposed to be doing, and half their stuff doesn't work anyway.
Well, and everyone looks Atari at Sega with blast processing. My ass. Yeah,
exactly. So with these bridge systems, you go from some really brilliant building blocks to crap systems overall.
Would you say, in general, to sum it up, that these bridge systems, the second generation, were great ideas that were just too far ahead of where the technology could realize these ideas?
They were good ideas in theory. They were very good ideas in theory. They never went to practice. And in all honesty, when you look at these and then you look at the generation that we're going to be talking about with the PlayStation, you just go, well, why didn't Sega just give me a Genesis with the CD built in, and there it was, and the 32X built in for a reasonable price.
It's something that seems so obvious in retrospect.
Exactly.
Yeah, in retrospect, it's so obvious.
Yes, and that's the way it goes. But we're going to talk about all of the next generation next week, so thanks a bunch for joining us, guys, and we will see you then.
Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.